you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Jay Dyer back on the show. Jay, how you doing?
Doing great, Tim. Always glad to be on Our Interesting Times because our times are interesting.
Very interesting in the worst kind of a way. And, of course, you are the proprietor of Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com. You're the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbolism in Film. And I understand you are taping a very important series of, television shows for the Gaia Network. Been very busy, so I'm very appreciative of your time with me tonight. Thank you. So I guess you're finishing up later on this week with those for the summer season.
Thank you for those kind words. Yeah, we finished 11 episodes, and we'll finish 17 or 18 by the end of this week. And, it's going to be a lot of really, really cool stuff. A movie analysis, kind of Siskel and Ebert style show that really doesn't exist. I don't think there's another Siskel Ebert style show that does film analysis, you know, the way that I do it. And it kind of linked up well with the style of Jay Wiedner, the way he does film analysis. And, you know, we have a good chemistry, a good rapport. So we kind of just go back and forth and give our thoughts and impressions of these seminal films and shows and kind of dissect them, you know, and it ties in well with Dave McGowan's work, a lot of the stuff that we're going to be talking about tonight. And we referenced, you know, Dave quite a bit. My work kind of builds on that, as well as Michael Hoffman's work too. So it's going to be neat. It's going to be, I think, very high quality. It's not stupid. It's not fluffy. It's going to be pretty hardcore, but it'll also be a lot of satire and comedy and, you know, joking around, hopefully too. They may edit out all my jokes. Maybe they sounded like they were laughing in the control room, but I couldn't tell. So maybe they're laughing at how bad it was. So I don't know. I hope my impersonations, you know, don't get edited out, but they may end up on the cutting room floor. I don't
know. What's the name of that show?
It'll be called Hollywood Decoded.
Hollywood Decoded. Okay, and that's going to air on the Gaia Network, and people, I guess, subscribe to that network?
Yeah, it'll have to be by subscription, but as I understand, you know, it's an anywhere streaming service, and it's also on some cable and satellite, so if you have Amazon Prime and that kind of stuff, you can get it too. So,
excellent, I do. Okay, so I can watch it. Okay,
it should be on all those, yeah.
Okay,
cool. I'm pretty sure that's right. I'm pretty sure Amazon has Gaia, but may need to check on that. But yeah, so we've got some good stuff lined up for season one. We've got David Lynch, and we've got some Kubrick, and we've got some Ridley Scott, Blade Runner, and the Alien franchise, and some X-Files. So there's a good lineup, and then a lot more to come. You know, if this does well, we'll do another two seasons on top of that. So
great. And of course, a lot of those movies I do after watching or listening, reading your analysis, listening to your analysis, you can go rewatch some of those movies that may seem a little strange, particularly David Lynch films. And you can really your analysis really helps.
And a lot of people have been saying that. They say when they get the book, they kind of read my book, and then they watch the movie and then read the chapter and watch the movie. So it's, you know, it ends up being kind of a fun thing. And I think the show will be too, because we have clips that we're playing too. So it's not just sitting, you know, me sitting there talking with Jay Wiedner. It's also, you know, important sections of the film you know, the images and the scenes and what's going on. So.
Your analysis of Ernest Goes to Camp was particularly enlightening. There was.
I wrote that as a joke, and then I had people who didn't think it was a joke, and they were like, "Do you really think this is about this?" And it says satire on there. It's tagged under satire.
Okay, it's great. And of course, listeners here, if you want to support Jay regularly, you can support his website for $4.95 a month, $60 a year. That's the regular thing. Support his research. Okay, well, tonight you've did an excellent analysis of Dave McGowan's Program to Kill. We've touched on it before in the past in our previous talks. I think our first conversation we talked a lot about that, but just touched on it. And you did almost a 2-hour analysis of it. Of course, I wanted to talk about that in light of the Michael Hoffman's analysis of the serial killer phenomenon, particularly the ritualistic aspect of it and the alchemical process that he believes that's involved with it,
right.
And the broader issue of sort of the societal degradation and debasement that occurred in the 1960s and 70s into the 80s, of course, in the context of the Vietnam War, the development of feminism, and all the psychological warfare that the American people have been subjected to since the Second World War. So, hey, how do you want to dive into it?
Well, I guess I could point out that in my own experience, I didn't grow up during that period. I grew up in the 80s, so I didn't know much about that era except through my dad. My dad was into Led Zeppelin and the Doors, and he would always play those albums. And that was really the only experience I had of it until I, you know, got to be older and started reading and getting into history and trying to make sense of what had been happening, especially in the United States. And then I think in my 20s, about 24 or 5, I read Hoffman's book, and that was a big piece of the puzzle for me. It was a big awakening stage for me. I think I've got it. That's
Secret Societies, Psychological Warfare?
Yeah. Okay. My copy is dated 2006, so... And he really opened up, I guess, a new way to look at things in a broad way. So he's really tying in the ideas of Hollywood and mass culture, pop culture, with the military-industrial complex and with secret societies and the occult, and, you know, how the Pentagon uses psychological warfare and ritual crimes and how it all kind of connects. So I think he's maybe one of the best figures that you could point to that kind of laid out a more coherent, unified field theory of conspiracy. Because, you know, I think prior to, I mean, maybe you could find somebody, I don't know, but I mean, when I think back to conspiracy texts written prior to 2001, which is when he published his book, you know, you would get books that might deal with a certain topic, like, you know, there would be books on the Templars, and there would be a book on the Masons, and then, you know, it's very limited subject matter. But I think Hoffman's book is a step towards meta-analysis, where he's really trying to put all these pieces together, and he ties in, you know, the theological aspects too, like making sense of what happened in the Catholic Church and at Vatican II and beyond. And it just made a lot more sense, I think. And so I was a traditional Roman Catholic at the time, attending the Latin Mass and so forth. So Hoffman had a big impact on me. And then I realized that he was kind of the first person I read that did kind of an esoteric movie analysis. So he kind of gave me the idea, or I got the idea to do that style from his analysis of conspiracy theory. He wrote a book on, or an essay on that a long time ago that's kind of famous. So it's a great all around book introduction. It's usually what I tell people who are new to the topic to read as an introduction. And I mean, I'm not sure where to start with it, just because he talks about so many things too. But Dave's book is a great companion to that book because they're kind of in the same vein. They do overlap at times, even though the focus of Program to Kill is more just on ritual crime. He's not really dealing with, theology or history per se. But one of the things that Dave starts out with that really impressed me in his book was that he looks like he read most of the material that's published dealing with, you know, MK Ultra and mind control. So, you know, there's Jose Delgado's Physical Control of the Mind, and there's Donald Bain's Control of Kenny Jones, and Walter Bowert's book, Operation Mind Control, and John Marx's book. And I've read a lot of these, but I haven't read all of them, but I've read a lot of these too. And so, you know, Hoffman's book kind of kicked me off on that 11 or 12 years ago. And then I read Jay Stevens' book, Storming Heaven, which is also kind of along the same path as Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, but not a little more watered down, a little more mainstream. And I read that a long time ago, and that kind of got me thinking, you know, that maybe a lot of what we were told about the 60s counterculture revolution was not what was really going on, and that maybe that wasn't real. And I had my own experiences of going to concerts and, you know, being around so-called hippies and the people of that counterculture mindset, because, you know, you start noticing as you get older that it's really just different costumes and dressings that people are wearing who are being counterculture. Right. So it's like the counterculture of my period when I was, you know, 18, 19, it was Nirvana. It was Pearl Jam. It was alternative music. It was, you know, that was just the next phase of the cultural dressing. And you start to realize that a lot of this stuff is not organic. It's actually top down. It's corporate. It's sold. And it runs contrary to what the whole ethos is that it's supposed to be an organic counterculture movement. And then I think, you know, just as you get older, you read more and you learn more and you realize that, you know, the people who run society are not idiots. They're very adept and they're masters of the scientific process and scientific technique of mass psychology. So I know I would even still recommend probably Jim Keith's book, Mass Control. It's a good introduction to this topic, and it fits well with Michael Hoffman's book and Dave McGowan's book. But anyway, just to kind of set the stage, you know, I just started diving into all these books, and you know, there really is a dearth of evidence to suggest that. Wait, is that the right word? I'm kind of tired. Dearth is dearth. Excess
no, dearth would be a lack of or ending of. Okay. Yeah,
there is an excess. Excuse me.
An
abundance of evidence, right, to suggest that that the counterculture movements are essentially, you know, engineered, and that's the main point here. And you say, well, how could that be? Why would that be? Well, when you look at what the Pentagon was studying, what the military was studying back into the 30s, 40s, and 50s, what the advertising agencies were studying, and it was mass psychology, mass sociology, and the mind of man. And if you could master the mind of man, then you could master the mass mind. And so all of these studies and all this research that the establishment put into mind control and physical control of the mind and all this kind of stuff, it manifested itself in all these very bizarre things. Like, you know, one of the MKUltra doctors, Dr. Jolyon West, gives a whole bunch of LSD to elephants just to see what it'll do. And you can go on YouTube and still see a lot of this old archive footage of some of these Stanford research experiments too, where they're giving LSD to all these animals and monkeys and seeing what it does. And you can watch the spider webs that were created by spiders that were given LSD and how they're all messed up and their webs don't work. And they really perfected, I think, the chemical approach to biological warfare is what this amounts to. And that's why it was classed eventually under biological warfare. So that's what impressed me about Dave's book. And having now read a lot of these books that he references, I think I have a much better picture of how the studies of multiple personality / dissociative identity disorder was of central import along with hypnotism for so many decades. And I think that you could argue that this is probably perfected. And of course, you know, Colin Ross has a lot of lectures and books that deal with the same topics too. So I think there's definitely something to this. Now there's a lot of disinformation that says that there's no such thing as, you know, fractured personalities and this kind of stuff. But it makes a lot more sense if this is true. Now I've had my own experiences with LSD when I was 17. So I know firsthand what happens. I had a bad trip the first time I did it. And so I understand the potentials and how it can cause multiple or fractured personality. Now, I mean, I don't think that I have alternate personalities or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that I know the process of what happens in throughout the acid trip. So I can see how these kinds of things occur. And if you read John Marks's book, he talks about that too. He talks about how they had actually studied the trip process and how it could cause dissociation. And then you get these popularizers, right, who go out into the pop culture, who sell it, like Timothy Leary. Now, Timothy Leary attaches all this esoteric stuff to it. And this is where you get the whole idea of promoting the archaic revival and indigenous religious traditions and all this kind of stuff attached to LSD and the promotion of hallucinogens. And I don't think we need to rehearse the Henry Luce Time. We all know that.
Yeah, yeah. Time, 1957, Time, right. Life magazine,
You've done plenty of interviews on that. And so, you know, you start to notice all these things and all these puzzle pieces that just don't make sense to be a counterculture revolution, you know. And, of course, that's the thesis of Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, you know, and I think he argues well in there that counterculture movement, to whatever degrees, maybe the anti-war movement, you know, was organic and legitimate, was eventually taken over and turned into just kind of this Dionysian base passion type of thing where, you know, Jim Morrison's up there like having sex with the speaker on the stage while he's bombed out of his mind on drugs, right? It just turns into total chaos, basically. And this chaos and dissociation, I think you can see it reflected in the artwork that was promoted, like Jackson Pollock and Andy Warhol and, you know, a lot of these CIA aided characters, these Frankfurt School type characters. And so to boil it all down, I mean, you really have, it's what Adorno talked about, you know, from the Frankfurt School, that if you promote inversion and perversion, you could really destroy the social order. And these wackos, these sickos, really believe that you had to destroy the social order to fix things. So that's I think the setting for the 60s. It was a whole bunch of things. It was psychological warfare. It was a lot of large scale testing of cults, of alternative lifestyles, quote unquote. You've done talks with John Adams. I've done interviews with John Adams, and he talks a lot about how California was kind of set up to be this mecca for the alternative lifestyle, you know, as well as promoting kind of the Silicon Valley military industrial complex aerospace stuff, you know, up towards Sacramento. You know, if you didn't like that, you could go down to L.A. or San Francisco or Haight-Ashbury or something and get involved in whatever cult you wanted, right? So it'd be, it's really, you just have this cornucopia of test tubes, I think, going on throughout the 60s. And I think that LSD was given on a mass scale on purpose. I think that was by design, absolutely. You know, when you look into the history of the drug war, you start to realize why that would be very plausible, especially given the importation of cocaine and crack for, you know, the black neighborhoods and stuff like that. We figure out that that's all true. So it just makes more, it makes a lot more sense that the culture is controlled and studied and created much more than it is, you know, any kind of organic process. And so that's the setting, that's the zeitgeist for both Hoffman's book and Dave McGowan's book.
Yes, you have in Program to Kill. Now, the way it's structured is he introduces the book first with organized elite pedophilia, the pediocracy, yeah. I think. And he's, I think the first 80 or 90 pages talks about the Mark Dutroux affair and these various exposure of pedophilic networks. And we all, I mean, just in recent news and just in our research, alternative research into the deep state and some of the intrigues of the intelligence agencies, the function that that serves, that child, that human trafficking, particularly with blackmail and human compromise.
Well, what's interesting too is that both of these books, you know, Hoffman's book was written in 2001 and Dave's book was written in 2004. And here we are, you know, it's 2017. And I had Hoffman's book a long time ago, and I would give this book out. People would call me crazy. They would hand it back to me. They'd be like, I read the first chapter here. Take this back.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that I'm sure Dave's book was received the same way. I only read, you know, Program to Kill fairly recently, but
yeah.
But the point, my point is just that look at how much of this has been vindicated, you know, in the last few years. So these are prescient books. And for me, you know, I mean, I don't want to be vindicated on this awful dark stuff, but, you know, it makes me realize that I'm not actually crazy. So all the people who, you know, called me nuts over the last 15 years or whatever.
Well, I get that. I say when people someone calls me crazy, I just say, no, you're just ignorant.
Yeah.
And then they get offended. Well, you just called me nuts, which is worse.
Like, yeah, right.
I mean, like, you just don't understand what they don't, you know, understand.
I don't mean to be arrogant, but I mean 99% of the time when people are operating that way, they've not read any of this stuff.
No,
so they don't have any working knowledge of this material. So,
yeah, you don't have the patience or the predilection to be tutored on this stuff. So, I'm not going to waste my time.
Right.
You know, just do the research, come back in 5 years, and then we'll talk about it. And that's what it takes. That's the problem, is there's no substitute for understanding these things other than just doing the research, reading the material, and thinking about it. And also holding out that, you know, there are some of these things that there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know. I don't know for sure. You know, there's a bias against, there's a bias towards certainty. And some of these things we don't have certainty with. We have to infer, have to, you know, speculate based on the information we have, you know, and that's only natural. I don't know what people expect. They create a unusually high standard, and it's selective too, because they'll accept the narratives and other things without any evidence, or just because they're told something, you know, because Walter Cronkite told them something, or they're, you know, or
yes,
Brian Williams. Go ahead.
There's a brilliant point that Dave makes in the Program to Kill at one point where he says, yeah, we're supposed to believe that the CIA never really got anywhere with MKUltra. It didn't really teach them anything about mind control and how to brainwash people. And, you know, they just kind of let this go after the hearings and all this stuff. However, we are at the same time supposed to believe from the official sources that all of these cult leaders have perfected the process of mind control, right? So
it's
David
a double
Koresh
think, yeah.
Jim Jones, you know, David Koresh and Jim Jones are masters of mind control, but the CIA and Pentagon, they just don't have a clue on it.
Yeah, with an unlimited budget, technology at their disposal. That's, I mean, that was the subtext or the argument of Charles Manson's conviction. He makes this very point, is the assumption of mind control on the part of Charles Manson. Because he apparently, the killers went out, and performed the massacres, and they were convicted. But they were to understand that they were controlled zombies. And the same time, Charles Manson, who according to the official narrative was never at any of the scenes, was convicted.
Right,
and it makes no sense. from a legal standpoint, yet they did it.
Exactly. And I just like the approach, because Dave's willing to look at the arguments of the skeptics, and one of the problems is that skeptics who say that there's not any substance to dissociative identity disorder or to any of this stuff is that they generally don't take into account all of the abundance of, for example, the material in Dave's book, right? So, so you'll get these people who try to debunk things, but they never deal with, like the totality of the 350 pages of this book. What about all this, right? I mean, I understand people being skeptical, and certainly not every time somebody claims something, it's true. But that's not a sound argument to debunk the whole idea of, maybe we don't understand everything about the psyche. That I've done a lot of reading and a lot of research into that. And, I don't think that the so-called establishment really understands or knows what the psyche, they might have perfected a lot of techniques when it comes to entrainment and psychic driving and these different, mind control techniques. But that doesn't mean that they really know what they're dealing with, because, St. Paul says who knows the soul of a man, but the spirit which is in him. Right. So even our souls and our spirits are somewhat mysterious even to us. So I don't think that the establishment has everything locked down on what man is or what man's soul is, precisely because most of these people have completely naturalistic presuppositions. So they don't think there is a soul. This is why everything's treated with chemicals and so forth. But anyway, he just provides a bunch of arguments for, people in the establishment even saying there's more going on here. These people aren't faking. You can look at experiments through hypnotism. Hypnotism has been studied for 80 years. So, obviously they've made some kind of progress there. Freud talks about ritual abuse. And then you have, the obviously suspicious fact of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation being founded by these CIA people who are involved in things like child trafficking and child porn and stuff.
That's right. It's, It was a Martin Orne or something? Who was?
Yeah, Orne. That's it.
Orne, who was MK Ultra scientist.
Oh yeah, he worked at Orne. Yeah, that's right. He worked
at MK. Okay.
Colin Ross has a good bunch of stuff on that. But
I think wasn't also Jolly West involved with them too.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay. False Memory Foundation. Now, for a point of clarification, Dave McGowan's thesis. In Program to Kill, and also it dovetails, or it's a good follow-up to his or actually preceded it, but to his Laurel Canyon book, because Laurel Canyon he points out that this dizzying array of some of the most popular musical bands of the 1960s having connections to military and intelligence, with the theory that the music itself was weaponized for the purposes of culture creation and sort of steering the culture in a certain direction, undermining the anti-war movement, the manipulation of the youth culture, the creation of the youth culture, which preceded it by a decade, I think, in the early 50s. And Program to Kill, he says, he puts forth the theory that the arrival of the serial killer phenomenon on the American landscape wasn't an organic development or an accidental development, coming out of America's post-war, environment of prosperity, youth culture, a sexual revolution. This was a plan. This was a weaponized system, like sort of a domestic application of the Phoenix Program,
Right.
And also an attempt to maybe an update or a modification of Murder Incorporated to carry out a certain amount of hits. And, you know, and also an attempt to shape the culture, to create a culture of fear to expand or the then burgeoning police state. SWAT teams, FBI, Quantico Lab and all this stuff, and the justification of budget. So that's the thesis of the book. Is that how you see his argument?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And the majority of the book is made up of the serial killing crimes and ritual crimes. And then you do have, like you said, those kind of early chapters that dealt with more of the sex crimes and pedophiles. But, you know, one of the themes that he mentions is that a lot of these people seem to have been known by the establishment, a lot of these deviants. And so the idea here is that because a lot of these people who were troubled, maybe they were brought up in very severely dysfunctional homes, and then maybe they were molested, and then having been through the system, they would have been fingered and earmarked as potential candidates for these kinds of things. Now that's very scary and that's very daunting, when we think about all the other material that's out there, for example, the way that Dr. Ewan Cameron was stationed at Mount Royal Psychiatric Institute in Canada, that's precisely what he was doing. He was finding troubled people in the psych wards to run his tests on. When we think about other aspects of the MKUltra program that were run through various universities and Human Ecology Foundation, or through these fronts, these psychiatric fronts, they were also working in prisons, like in Louisville, Kentucky. Lexington, Kentucky, I think. Was one of the sites where they were picking out prisoners, according to John Marks's book. So that dovetails well with Dave's thesis, which is just that if you've grown up in the system, you know, with somebody like Charles Manson, you know, he's a great example who's, you know, he was in juvenile problems from like day one, right? So he would have been known to the system is what we're trying to say here. And that a lot of these guys seem to have a curious pattern of where they end up, and the serial killers tend to have these time periods where they spent a good bit of time in California, Texas, and Florida. And so Dave kind of theorizes that what you have is in these states is, number one, they're kind of obvious to military industrial complex type states, especially with a lot of the bases in California, and then you have a lot of drug running that would be related to the Texas-Mexico border, and then obviously drug running from waterways, into Florida. So, so that requires a lot of deep state apparatus, in other words, to keep the drug situation flowing. And when you have one black market like drugs, you oftentimes have the other ones too, like human trafficking. So drugs and human trafficking requires sometimes threats and hitmen, and the serial killer phenomenon then can have many uses, right? So you mentioned those in your description, but of course Dave also mentions the possibilities of unsolved murders. These can be haystacked, I think is the term that you've used, where police departments, the haystacking is where you have a target, but you sort of blend them in amongst a whole bunch of people that you've killed, so it appears random. So that's another one of the theses here. And then you also have the notion, like you said, of haystack or police departments kind of stacking these onto one guy. Oh, Henry Lee Lucas killed, 200 people or whatever, which seems a little bit implausible.
Yeah, they took him on a tour. He went around and said, I did that one. Yeah, I did that one. Yeah, that was me too.
But I think it's fascinating too that he tends to mention with these characters that they could have been picked out because they had dissociative identity disorder. And that may not necessarily mean that they were like programmed in the sense of you know, like sent on the mission to do this. Now, it may have been in some cases, but rather that they would have been chosen as people who already had mental problems is what I'm trying to say. That would be the cover, right? They would never be suspected for being used by the establishment or some nefarious group precisely because they're crazy.
Yeah. And the reason, I mean, the suspicion that sort of identification process was in place, well, with MKUltra, the psychiatric profession was completely taken over by the military and intelligence for the purposes of doing just that. So, I mean, good example, you mentioned obviously Ewan Cameron up in Canada, and he was funded by the Human Ecology Fund, the CIA. I mean, this goes back, was it George Estabrooks, World War II? Right. You've over in the UK, you have the Tavistock Institute, which identified, you know, shell shock and trauma and how it could be weaponized and manipulated.
PTSD, yeah.
Yeah, PTSD. And the various, I think every prominent psychiatric hospital institution was some way or another involved with MKUltra back in the 50s and 60s. Same with you mentioned the prisons, Vacaville. Angola prison in Louisiana, and you mentioned the one in Kentucky. So that's been established. some of the heavy hitters in psychiatry and psychology were part of MKUltra. And so that sort of reporting mechanism would be there, just for that.
Exactly right. And even the public information is over 40 universities and institutions like that were involved. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that would include, I'm assuming, universities that we probably would like, you know, it would be some of the obvious ones like Stanford and Harvard. You know, Ted Kaczynski was part of the MKUltra project in Harvard.
Yeah, that's right. And I think his victims were connected to SRI.
Yeah, okay.
If the official narrative has any truth to it.
Right.
Which is interesting. I mean, he was an MKUltra test subject or victim.
By the way, just a little aside here. Have you seen Spellbound?
With Gregory Peck? Right.
Yeah. And
I saw it years ago with Ingrid Bergman. Years ago, all the Freudianism I thought was hilarious in it.
Well, it is Freudianism, but what's interesting is that if you go back and watch it, Gregory Peck is being used as the there's a doctor at the institute who's framing Gregory Peck for murder.
That's right.
He's doing that because Gregory Peck has dissociative identity disorder and he can't remember what he's done. So I was like, this is like in the 40s. And I was watching this the other day. I was like, man, this is kind of like an analogy for a lot of the MKUltra type stuff. This fits well with David Gallant's book because this guy believes that he's committed the murder. And it was actually the head of the psychiatric institute.
Yeah, that's the one with all the Salvador Dali art in it.
Correct. Yes, it has surrealist, all-seeing eye artwork.
And I think it was George Estabrooks. He was during World War II, was talking about mind control and hypnosis and trauma to create dissociative disorder or multiple personalities.
Correct. Yeah, the essay "Hypnosis Comes of Age," which is the most famous one that you can read. It's online, and it's the 1971 or 2 Science Digest essay that he wrote, and that's where he kind of lays out his bragging about, oh, I can do. I mean, I think the essay is older than 1971, but that's where you'll find it online, is in that format. But that's where he describes the process of hypnosis and the courier and the keywords and the triggers and all that.
And so, did you catch my interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell recently on Common Core?
I did, yeah.
And he's made in that interview and also in several, and in the book, of course, he connected the Electronic Testing Service to the Human Ecology Fund.
Mm-hmm. I did hear that.
And when you're talking about, you're talking how these guys could be identified, profiled as, you know, through the various, because they're identified as being psychological.
Well, you
problems.
Have the standardized testing, exactly.
Standardized testing, yeah. And so now, and of course, that was all done at the behest. I mean, they contacted, I think it was Conant, I think, at Harvard, who ran it or something. I forget the name right, if I remember. But basically, it was done to not just to identify, you know, the best and the brightest, or to sort of to channel people into the professions they think people should do based on their testing parameters or standards or whatever. But you could you talk about today, I mean, talk about what the military does with video games, right? This interactive video games that go to the Pentagon. First shooter games, these things being monitored.
Yeah, come be the drone pilot and kill everybody at the wedding.
Yeah. So these people can be identified like that. So I was imagining the technology is far more advanced now, just with obviously with the internet and with our smart devices everywhere and everything being monitored, what we read, what we buy, our habits being monitored digitally, and that could that could flag certain. You could get flagged. Okay, here we go. We got somebody.
Yeah, so let's go. That's a good point.
So again, it's one that people hear this stuff and says no. I mean, the literature, the history is there, and it's been acknowledged that this was done. And again, all the universities, all the psychiatric hospitals, these prisons, these institutions, that are supposed to help us protect society, were weaponized. To do something quite opposite of what their public charter claims they're there to do.
And if anybody doubts that, all you have to do is read the works of Birch and Russell to understand the scientific outlook. Because it's ruthless. It's not moral. They don't have any qualms of using people in that way.
And, of course, in the book, he just goes through a list of these serial killers. They all, well, not all of them, but almost military intelligence backgrounds, Vietnam experience.
Have that connection, right, yeah. And that's where we would get the potential Phoenix connection. But I thought it was interesting that I didn't actually know a whole lot about Henry Lee Lucas. But, you know, he points out a lot of suspicious things, like being pardoned by W.
Yeah.
He's a good man. Henry Lucas, good boy. He's a good boy. Right? But so he claims that he was in a satanic cult, though. Now, so I don't know if it's true, but that's what Henry Lee Lucas claimed, that the Hand of Death cult, you used him, and that he was a contract killer, and that this was associated with human trafficking from Juarez into presumably El Paso or Brownsville or somewhere. And this, of course, connects to the death cult MS-13, which is the Latin American gang that's, connected to all this kind of stuff. And I believe has to have some kind of help from above. I don't mean God. I mean from above, from the government. Especially because I've watched some documentaries on Santa Muerte, which is the cult which a lot of the MS-13 are into. And you look at the guys who run this cult, and they're just totally shady, obviously involved in some kind of thing. And that jives well with a lot of what Dave claims in the Henry Lee Lucas chapter. And, you know, this is where he's a good example of kind of the archetype of what his thesis is, because Henry was Office of Naval Intelligence or had some connection there, or he was spotted there, and maybe there's some connection to NATO. I'm looking back at the book here. Careful screening of subjects was accomplished by the Navy psychologist in the military records. Many were convicted murderers serving prison sentences, and they were put into this program. Yeah, here we go. So he's arguing that in Chapter 8 that Henry Lee Lucas was probably one of these people in this kind of a program. And the military is ruthless. You have to understand that, too. Like, they're just as ruthless as the scientism of Bertrand Russell. Like, they don't have any qualms of, I mean, they're in the business of killing people.
They weaponize everything.
Right. So, to a lot of people, this is just sounds so, well, we're American. We wouldn't do that. You know, we have the Wounded Warrior Project. We go back and grab our wounded men. We carry them back. Right. But no, that's not really, I mean, obviously a lot of people in the military are good natured and would do that, but that doesn't mean that that's the modus operandi of the totality of the military. I mean, there's, it's compartmentalized. There's all kinds of secret projects and stuff like this. And so you know, Dave just kind of lists a whole bunch of these characters that's, that seem to pop up around the same time. And you have Berkowitz, and you have, I think he mentions Jim Jones or in some capacity. I don't know that Jim Jones was necessarily a military connection, although we know that he had the connection to Dan Mitrione, who was the CIA guy down in...
Was it Paraguay? Paraguay or Uruguay? I forget one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
hello? Was... Can you hear me? You're getting really...
Hello?
You're cutting up really bad.
Oh, really? How about now?
No, it's just super staticky.
Okay, let me give you a call back.
Okay.
Now clear it up. Thanks.
All right. I think this chapter 8 is one of the more important chapters in the book, because this is where he's talking about, they're called CTs, criminal, I don't know what that stands for, but these are the people who are in the Phoenix program, and they're the ones that are trained to, they're kind of profiled to be the psychos, and then they're kind of let loose, obviously, under the auspices of psychological terror against the Viet Cong. And then these people come back, and, you know, they're already known to the military, so they could be put to all kinds of use, right? And that's a very enticing theory, I think.
Yeah, because what do you do with these men once they come back?
Yeah, what do you do with these guys, right? And so anyway, that's I'm flipping through the chapter. So that was a really important chapter, and I didn't know anything about the Matamoros cult. That was totally new to me. I'd heard of it, but that was new to me. And then, so you just realize that there's so many examples of this stuff that it's kind of just been forgotten in the news. Like, I remember this back in the 80s or 90s or whenever it was, but in the 80s. But, you know, we were told that there was, that was all a satanic panic created by Geraldo.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There was no real Satanism. There was none of this. It was just a panic. Throughout the 80s and 90s, the Juarez was the world capital for missing women. And I actually went and looked up a lot of Dave's claims and articles on this, only because I had traveled last summer to California and stopped in El Paso on the way, and I saw Juarez, and it made me think of the movie Sicario, and I was thinking, good grief, it just looks so awful over at Juarez. And in Sicario, the story is that the FBI girl is tricked into working with this military attaché. She's attaché for a military outfit that's run by the CIA, and she thinks that she's going to take out a drug dealer assassin. And really, all what was happening was that the CIA was taking out a rival drug dealer.
Yeah,
and so they duped the FBI girl. Anyway, so that all takes place in Juarez in the movie. And I'm sitting here reading this chapter in Dave's book, and I'm like, this is straight out of, this sounds just like Sicario. And you know, it's not hard to believe. I mean, if you go and you look at the border wall there in El Paso, and you look over into Juarez, it just looks like it looks like a hellhole.
Well, they got to keep it a hellhole because it's also a good source of cheap labor for the.
Well, that's what Dave said, points out too. Yeah. Is that this is a big part of NAFTA, was being able to move all the sweatshops there. But you know, he argues that there's a lot more going on, that it's not just sweatshops, that, you know, the women are going missing for a reason. So,
yeah, well, yeah, that Rancho Diablo, which is an interesting name for a ranch.
Yes, that comes up in here too, right? Yeah. Now, is that the one that's connected to the Matamoros?
Uh-huh. And they was raided by the Texas Rangers eventually.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And they found bones all over the place. And again, for people ignored it for years. That's just a rumor. It's a myth. And I think that's the one that Henry Lucas talked about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And
it is.
Henry Lucas is an interesting story because, you know, he's supposed to be the serial killer. Of course, he teamed up with two, three different people at a time. One of his partners,
Otis Toole,
who has been linked to the death of Adam Walsh, and everyone knows, you know, the what's that show on Fox? Not Most Wanted. What was it? Walsh. He had that show on Fox News.
America's Most Wanted. Wanted.
Of course, that was in 1981, his son went missing in a Sears and Roebuck in 1981, and the boy's head was found floating in the canal. Otis Toole was taken in for questioning for that crime, and the police at the time lost the machete and even the automobile that he had used, and they let him go. And he was in prison again later on, and he supposedly confessed to that crime. And if you know, you're probably too young to remember, but I remember that very well because that was one of these national stories. We started getting national stories in the 80s about missing kids. We didn't get those in the 70s. It was always regional. Mm-hmm. He went on Phil Donahue's show and all this, and it became a crusade about missing and exploited children. And, of course, the fact that the head was separated, suggests some sort of maybe a satanic thing. But This gets into this the alchemical, element of the serial killer phenomenon that Michael Hoffman gets into, but even Dave McGowan talks about it, creating fear, creating an atomized society where kids can no longer go out and play, communities no longer cohere. This just getting it out there like that would terrify the community, and it was a trauma for the entire nation the way the media covered it. And what's strange is, of course, this Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, who Otis Toole's arrested, George Bush, the governor of Texas. But you, again, in all these cases, whether it's the same thing with John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Otis Toole, is inexplicable police incompetence, the failure to follow up on things, and that's what he points out.
Yeah, and this comes to the fore, especially in the case of. My mind just went blank. After I read the book, I watched a 4-hour TV movie about.
Oh, that was on John Wayne Gacy with Brian Dennehy.
Yes, yeah, with Dennehy, right? And yeah, so here he's essentially now the TV show movie, the TV movie kind of hints at it, but not really. They don't go into the fact that he seems to have been operating very well with the local police. Mm-hmm. As if maybe he was maybe their guy, like their guy to take out people. Because if there was a gay prostitution / drug ring, then presumably in that kind of a setting, you're going to be worried about narcs. And so you might need to have somebody around to take out the narcs. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's exactly what was going on with him, but I mean, that makes sense in terms of the police incompetence and the fact that he was this very prominent member of the community and the JCs and, all these civic organizations that he was a part of.
Dave McGowan makes a point in the book. He talks about the whole idea of the serial killer profile. He says, most Americans are probably familiar with what is considered the classic serial killer profile. This was the notion first put forth by the venerable FBI, which coined the term serial killer, and pioneered the concept of profiling in an alleged attempt to understand the phenomenon of the mass murder. It appears to be the case, though, that the concept of the serial killer profile was put forth to largely misinform the public. And if you scrutinize these cases, one can't help but agree with Mr. McGowan on that point, because none of them, like the bind, torture, and kill killer, none of his supposed kills follow any profile, and that's one. Case of haystacking potentially, because one of his first kills was this military guy who told his son that someone's after him, and the whole family was wiped out. His wife, who was trained in martial arts, two dogs I think were killed, another son, and him.
Right, and Dave makes the argument that it looks a lot more like a special operations trained person came in and did this, as opposed to, this weird, creepy guy that's just kind of, stalking around the neighborhood, like we're told it is.
Mm-hmm. And, you meant in your talk, you talked about the Zodiac killer,
mm-hmm.
And how there's a boot that was identified as being a Navy issue or something.
Right.
So it's military. Yeah. And I guess that seems like there are again, that seems to be a case where there are a lot of people doing it. Similar with Son of Sam.
People. Yeah. Right. Yeah, like Berkowitz said, and then Berkowitz says, oh, I was working at the behest of a larger satanic cult.
The of course, Son of Sam case came on later. That was the 70s. And Maury Terry's book posited the theory that it was a cult doing it, and he just...
Right.
Berkowitz himself said he was only at two of the shootings.
Right.
Michael Hoffman sort of examines that case and talking about all the evidence suggesting that it was indeed multiple, perpetrators.
One of the points of Oliver Stone / Quentin Tarantino's movie Natural Born Killers is that the media is really what creates and gives everybody the impression of the serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know how cognizant they were of Dave's book, but I'm saying, or Dave's word, because I think that movie came out when I was in high school. But the point of the movie is that the media makes these people into stars. Their media creations is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so that once again shows the role of mass media in terms of psyops, because if Dave's thesis is right, then that's why we don't see them anymore. They're not needed anymore. Where did all the serial killers go? Where are they?
Yeah, the work's been done, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
When the serial killer emerged, I guess the late 60s, I think the Zodiac Killer was probably, or at you at the DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler. Mm. Another case where doesn't fit any of the profile. In fact, people think he went to prison for his being the Boston Strangler. He didn't. He was convicted for another crime, and I think it was weird. F. Lee Bailey was his lawyer who presented the strange defense that he was not innocent, not guilty of the crime he was charged because he was busy strangling somebody. I think that was his defense.
Wow.
But DeSalvo himself looks like some sort of mind control victim. Again, there was no age. Women of all ages. There's no profile to it, and it's just one of these weird cases.
Oh, by the way, Ted Bundy also is one. Claims that there were other people involved.
Yeah, so
that it wasn't just him as the lone gunner.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing. You remember, he's able to break out of prison and kill multiple girls at a sorority, and
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, how does he? Oh, he breaks out of prison and is able to... Same thing with Richard Speck. Remember his case? And he broke into the nurse's dorm or something and was able to murder multiple girls as they waited. I mean, they were like locked in a room and waited.
Interesting.
One by one.
But I don't remember the detail. But I remember you noticed this coming up too. Richard Ramirez's case, he seems to have been trained by his relative, who was a military killer of some sort.
Yeah, he was in Vietnam. I think his cousin, older brother or something. Yeah, Richard.
And then Bobby Joe Long is the cousin of Henry Lee Lucas.
That's all in the family.
That is unbelievable. Yeah.
But look at the context of when this is happening. We're talking about the 1960s, the Vietnam War, and what the Vietnam War represented. A lot of motivations for that war wasn't the domino theory. Obviously, one was big war contracts, a lot of spending, Kellogg Brown en route, a lot of harbors to be dredged, a lot of helicopters get shot down and maintained and replaced and these things. Another motivation for the war, of course, was heroin. We've talked about that. But another one, I think, when I talked to Chris Milligan, he comes up with the theory that the war itself was intended as a trauma for society. It's society to kind of create a divide between generations.
Yes.
And this goes into the broader theory behind the counterculture. And in order to get the counterculture, you needed a war to protest. The overall trauma of that war, of course, within that war, the war itself provided a great opportunity not only to experience, to test various weapon systems, weapon platforms, but also psychological warfare. Of course, Doug Valentine's work on the Phoenix program is invaluable in understanding the Phoenix program, what its intent was to it's a counterinsurgency program to destroy what was referred to as the civilian infrastructure of the Viet Cong. Of course, what that really means is, on the ground, is killing a lot of innocent people, torturing a lot of people, terrorizing them.
It's what you see in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And, yeah, and that's, of course, created by William Colby.
Mm-hmm.
I just lost my train of thought. I was going to say...
Well, the implication is that if, in order to subdue the civilian population of Vietnam to achieve whatever objective the U.S. government had in Vietnam at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I remember now. So, what you start to notice is that the these operations that run foreign psychological operations, this is what I've been noticing the last couple of years, especially when you study the phenomena of the color revolutions and Arab Spring and then all that kind of stuff. And then you also look at the School of the Americas and the death squads. And then you start to realize that the foreign ops are kind of test tubes. And then maybe it looks like at times they'll bring that back home and do it domestically. So it's not, this is a pattern, I guess, that's been going on for a long time, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and it's an attempt to destabilize. And, of course, you're going to destabilize Honduras or El Salvador or Peru or Chile in a different way that you destabilize, you know, Springfield, America, Los Angeles. The idea of the Phoenix program, obviously things like the, Department of Homeland Security grew out of the Phoenix program, the ideas before it, you know, the basic idea of the whole idea of fusion centers is an adaptation of the Phoenix program to monitoring people. So all these things don't go away. They're tested and they're modified. But the idea of destabilizing the home front for a particular reason, for some sort of, as Michael Hoffman would say, some sort of alchemical process, so sort of to debase or degrade, to break down, to atomize civilization, the community. And obviously you get that with the fear of crime and the serial killer. He talks about it.
That's Negredo, the blackening.
There you go. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Exactly. There you go. It says, of course, many serial murders are nothing more than the work of a single individual acting out a graphic horror movie he saw, or responding to a powerful psychotic impulses for aggression and predation. But many other serial murders involve a cult protected by the U.S. government and the corporate media with strong ties to the police. These murders, obviously you're citing like John Wayne Gacy, there's evidence of that. These murders are actually intricately choreographed rituals performed first on a very intimate and secret scale among the initiates themselves in order to program them, then on a grand scale, amplified incalculably by the electronic media, like natural born killers, right?
Right.
Yeah, so there you go. And this is what gets, in the end, what we have is a highly symbolic ritual working broadcast to millions of people, a satanic inversion, a black mass where the pews are filled by the entire nation and through which humanity is paganized, brutalized, and debased in this Negredo phase of alchemical process.
I was right. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. You're right. Yeah. So I'm impressed you remembered that. I can see you reading that if you're just like an average Joe, you know, who just, what is this guy talking about? Yeah. But the, and you see that in Berkowitz, you see that in Bundy, you see it in John Wayne Gacy, and all these things.
Back to Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper as he chases back to, I forget who the guy's name, Lord Gall, I think, or what was his name?
One of these like high level British Mason guys.
Freemason abortionist, yeah.
Yeah.
And the point is, and he makes the point in Psychological Warfare and Secret Societies, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, is this sort of process won't work in a society that's healthy. So society has to be broken down bit by bit gradually. Where if society gets brutalized enough and degraded enough, then it does work because a healthy society will have natural defense mechanism for these things.
Yes, he uses the term theater of cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole nation or the whole society becomes like the horror movie, and it's intended to brutalize. And that kind of goes, it's a trauma-based mind control on a mass scale. And so in Dave's book, he talks about the blooding. I'd never heard it called that. I've just always heard people say, you know, people that are severely disturbed, like these killers, you know, they're just traumatized. But he calls it a blooding, that at a certain point in their lives when they're younger, they're intentionally exposed to the macabre and to something bloody or traumatic. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Like, you know, they're 16 and they get a job at a morgue or something. And they're like dealing with cadavers, and then, you know, weird stuff's going on. And, you know, this is, I'm not saying that it's everybody who is a mortician's evil. I'm just saying that in the cases of these people, he's noted that as a consistent pattern, that, you know, they had some sort of grotesque exposure, you know, that scarred them, I guess, in some way at a formative period in their life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he makes the point, what this trauma creates is, he says it's what we observe in the population today are the three destructive symptoms of persons whose minds are controlled by alien forces. I guess what it means by that is the psychological warfare. Amnesia, i.e. loss of memory, abulia, loss of will, and apathy, loss of interest in the events vital to one's own health and survival. Amnesia, abulia, and apathy are nearly universal among us today and gaining a greater foothold each passing day. This is done, again, through the electronic media, through entertainment. He even talks about, breads and circuses and the effects.
Yeah, that Negredo process. It's page 67, that may have been where you were reading, but he says, in the end, we have a highly symbolic ritual broadcast to millions of people, a satanic inversion, a black mass where the pews are filled with the entire nation, the Negredo phase. And then he goes on to say, the French adept Antonin Artaud, architect of the theater of cruelty, wrote about this in terms of the group mind. Aside from trifling witchcraft of country sorcerers, there are tricks of global hoodoo. Mm-hmm. In which all alerted consciousness participate periodically. That is how the strange forces are aroused and transported to the astral vault, to that dark dome. Now, this all sounds kind of crazy, but what the guy's saying is that when you have a huge event, like the whole nation's fixated on Manson, or the whole nation's fixated on Zodiac or 9/11, that it's understood that you can reason from the individual to the collective. So if you have an individual who is traumatized because he's fixated on, you know, the shock that happened, that you can do that same process on a mass scale through having everybody's energy and focus, you know, and attention on, you know, whatever this gigantic so-called crime is, Zodiac or Manson or whatever. And that what that does is then that everybody's participating in this process of being ritualized. You're going through the ritual process. I've written a bunch of articles on how mass media is like a ritual process, but anyway, that's what Hoffman's saying, is that just hammering home that point that I've been arguing too, that you can reason from the individual to from the micro to the macro scale to understand. And that's exactly what they did with MKUltra, is they expanded the individual studies to the mass, you know.
Yeah, but same, not just through the with drug distribution, and also with mass media and psychological warfare.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's the part he says it much better than I said. He says he's talking about revelation, the method, and talking about why would they reveal what they're doing? What how would that serve the interest of the cryptocracy? He says, why would the perpetrators want their secrets revealed after the fact, even if it is years later? The question can only be definitively answered if one has an understanding of the zeitgeist which overseers in the cryptocracy have partly manufactured and partly tailored their own operations to coincide with. As I've pointed out, secrets like this were rarely revealed in the past because traditional people had not yet completed the alchemical processing. To make such perverse modern revelations to an unprocessed, healthy, vigorous population, possessed of will, memory, and adherence to their deepest inner intuition and interest in, intense interest in their own salvation, would not have been a good thing for the cryptocracy. It would have proved fatal to them. But to reveal it after the acts of secret... But to reveal it, you know, after they've been processed... I lost my quote there. Well, basically, to reveal it later after they've been processed, they can't respond to it. They fall into that, what he was talking about, loss of will, loss of memory, and apathy, and they can then be they can then be manipulated.
Yeah, it's like the hypnotist with the victim there, you know, like Svengali. He's like, this is the government of Svengali, and you're the beautiful young maiden. The population. Exactly.
But again, what you're, and we're talking again, what's going on again, it's what's, why this would go, it's the serial killer would come on the scene in the late 60s in the height of the Vietnam War, and going into the 70s, you have the economic crisis of the 1970s, the closing of the gold window, the end of Bretton Woods, the debasement of the dollars, and coincides with also the cultural debasement of the American people, this feminism, the promotion of perversion like gay rights through Planned Parenthood, these things. This is turning society upside down and making everyone confused. The targeting of things like the family that was that occurred would also lead to further degradation and also further trauma, which would complete the process. What you're seeing now, the confusion we're seeing.
Exactly. Yeah. Know. Yeah. I mean, the alchemical process includes the period or the stage of androgyny. And that's ultimately the meaning of the Baphomet symbol. Mm-hmm. Baphomet is androgynous, has both genders. And if you listen to a lot of interviews with these people who are really into this trans stuff, and I'm speaking kind of across the board, like if they're into transhumanism or maybe transvestite, but there's some pop culture so-called icons who I've watched documentaries on who talk about their beliefs and why they wanted to change their genders, like this weirdo Genesis P. Orridge, who's a kind of a punk figure, post-punk or whatever you call it. Just makes noise. The guy's mentally unstable, obviously. But he went through the gender process, or to some degree, gender change, reassignment, whatever. And he goes into it and he starts talking about alchemy. He says, well, I'm a fervent believer in alchemy, and I believe that in the original state of whatever the divine was, or whatever we evolved from, that it was neither male nor female, or in some cases, they'll actually say they believe that it was female, that we all evolved from like some sort of feminine primal cell. Mm-hmm. So you get all the, in other words, it's all based on nonsense. It's all based on myths and Gnostic fables. But they will say that since, and this is in Neoplatonism too, and Platonism, the original unity could not have any distinctions or particularities. It couldn't have masculinity or femininity, so it had to be that has to be the state that we got to get back to, right? And this fits all into the stuff that Huxley talks about openly. So we have to get rid of distinctions. The enemy of the future will be distinctions, distinct nations, distinct genders, distinct races, distinct religion, distinct claims. All that has to be destroyed in the name of unity and globalism. That's literally what Huxley says. So they are aware of alchemy. In fact, I think even Kessler in Ghost of the Machine talks about the whole process as alchemy. And you say, well, they're scientists. They don't believe in medieval alchemy. Well, those are just terms for the same process, right? So if you're taking a fish scale and putting it into a tomato to make the tomato's skin stronger against pesticides, you're not doing anything different than what a medieval alchemist wanted to do. Mm-hmm. He just didn't have the means to do it or the technology to do it, but that's at least what he was trying to do, was, you know, mess up creation and whatnot. And that's really what alchemy is just the attempt to, it's the domination of nature through techne, ultimately at the chemical biological level. That's what I read alchemy as. So, yeah, I mean, there's all this kind of spiritual stuff that people try to tack onto it. Of John Dee would say, "Oh, I can turn base matter into God. You can become God through my alchemical steps and Enochian magic." But I think a lot of that stuff they were just con men. You know, alchemy is more so chemistry. That's what it eventually becomes is chemistry. But what is so fascinating is that even if we deride or laugh at the notion of alchemy, you know, what the establishment is doing, what genetics research is doing, what bioengineering is doing, what geoengineering is doing, is actually, you know, creating the monstrosities that the alchemists talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not literal. Well, I don't know what they actually do in cloning labs. Who knows what they're doing? But when we look at, you know, Sinomics, and we look at the aborted fetal cells being used for the flavoring in Pepsi and for the vaccines, which is all true, you know, that's alchemy. That's dark alchemy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, you also made it interesting because in your talk, you talk about serial killers and Michael Hoff made a point that basically it's the promotion of thanatosis, so the cult of death that's mm-hmm. being promoted in all this. And you mentioned, women with multiple abortions and mm-hmm. how sort of the...
That's never mentioned as psychopathy.
Yeah. But he makes... It's very funny because in psychological warfare, secret society and psychological warfare, he says, of course, no matter what her affiliations, Sharon Tate's murder was a heinous crime. It's interesting to note that while much is made of the murder of her unborn baby as being the most horrible part of the Mason gang's occult violence, women who pay physicians to kill their unborn babies are not regarded as guilty of any satanic act, heinous or otherwise. Was the sacrifice of Sharon Tate's unborn baby somehow a ritual precursor for the coming mass sacrifice of unborn children, which was subsequently legalized by the United States Supreme Court? So this was August 1979. Of course, Roe v. Wade is January 1973. That was an interesting point.
And think about, and here we are now with Kurt Gosnell.
Mm-hmm.
Gods like that. So I mean, people might balk at the idea of ritual and power behind these kinds of acts, but if you, I'm not saying that shamanism is true. Obviously, I don't believe in shamanism, but if you read the approach that shamans have, or the how they go about their process of understanding the world and their ritual process and all that, even though I think they're totally wrong, in a way, it's perhaps, spiritually speaking, a little more closer to the mark, because they understand that, you know, they're tapping into entities on the other side. And we would laugh at that, balk at that in modern America, and we think that that's so superstitious and stupid. But, you know, there are many, many indigenous tribes and shamans out there in the world, and there many of them still take hallucinogens. This is being promoted in our country. I've had bad experiences on hallucinogens. So I know directly that, you know, you're tampering with the psyche and you're tampering with your spirit. And that's a dangerous road to go down. And I also think that the LSD was a big part of it, that just as the shaman goes through an initiation, the promotion of LSD, I think, was a kind of ritual process, because, again, when Gordon Wasson and, you know, these characters went and got the ergots for the creation of LSD mm-hmm. at the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Corporation, they were also aware of what the shamans were able to do when the shamans would initiate people. So you cannot divorce these drugs from that process, even though we tend to think of them as divorced from it. Like, oh yeah, we're just partying, we're just hanging out. And I'm saying that, no, there's an actual power behind these things that's very dangerous. And that's why so many people go crazy and, jump out of buildings and plunging to their death. And, they get lost in other realms in their mind. They're crazy. All that stuff happens for a reason, because this is very dangerous. And basically what I'm saying is that it's satanic is what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that drugs in themselves are always bad. Obviously, nothing that God created in itself is evil. But what I'm saying is that the mass promotion of these things and the pharmaceutical usage of these things, I think, generally speaking, is not for human well-being.
Yeah, well, that's, if you look at the how many college students, I think John Rappaport did a thing, had an article talking about how 25% of college students are receiving psychiatric care.
Yes.
And they're being diagnosed, and they're given, psychotropic drugs to deal with their problems.
Mm-hmm.
When, anyone looking at why a freshman or sophomore in college might have living problems because they're away from home for the first time, not doing well. Maybe they received a bad poor education in high school. Maybe, I don't know, maybe, they're feeling guilty because they're hooking up too much. Maybe they're, all mm-hmm. types of things that have nothing to do with, that can be dealt with through pharmacology.
Yeah.
But the schools themselves have become not only instruments for debt bondage, predatory loan institutions, but they've also become a mass mind control operation, not just through poor education or indoctrination, but through drugs, apparently.
Right. Yeah. I would recommend people too. I did an essay or an article, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, but I can't remember the name of the title, something like Masculine Feminine Wisdom or something like that. And it's about the drug experience. And I'm actually arguing against the use of hallucinogens because I see them as such a spiritual danger.
Mm-hmm.
But see, nobody talks about them as a spiritual danger. And that's what's very surprising to me, because you can watch the BBC documentaries, a whole series of this guy, Bruce Perry, I think is his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he just totally, really stupid on his part, went and found like 10 or 12 different indigenous tribes. And he went through the ritual process of all of these tribes to be initiated in. And most of them involved the usage of hallucinogens and pretty heavy toxins at times. And, he describes this process too. And he eventually came to realization that it couldn't really be divorced from its spiritual significance. And it ended up being a bad thing for him. Like he felt like he had to go get psychiatric help eventually after he had done all this, which is completely stupid. I mean, assuming that he really did all this, that it wasn't like a BBC put on or something.
Yeah.
Assuming he really did this, he had to get psychiatric help, and he had experienced too much dark stuff. But I swear on it that it's real. You will encounter dark things. Not every time, not every single person. I can't speak for it, because it's more of a, like, you kind of take this inner journey and you're kind of forced to deal with the issues that you have. Now, some people think that that's a positive thing and that psychology should utilize these things. I don't think it is. I think that's a trick. I think it's totally dark. You look at the history of the church, for example, when the church would do its missionary work and they would find these indigenous tribes and so forth that were doing this, it's almost always the same thing. Like the shamans who have been blasted their mind on these drugs and try to control the people through these drugs, these are not healthy people. We have this mistaken assumption that, oh, all the innocent, the noble savage, right, of Rousseau or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. These people are not noble savages. So that all needs to be, I think, debunked. And who's the woman who did the famous anthropologist who?
Margaret Mead?
Margaret Mead, yeah, her stuff was debunked too. That she was,
yeah, she, of course, she was the spouse of Gregory Bateson, who was weaponized anthropology.
Exactly. Yes,
it was all done to exploit primitive people. Then the only problem is they look at us as primitive. The general public is primitive, being for being manipulated. A while back, I interviewed Dr. Hans Uter, and we were talking about this very thing, actually. And he's talking about Ewan Cameron and some of Ewan Cameron's research over there at the Allen Memorial Institute, was to see if psychosis could be, could spread like a disease, like a contagion.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's interesting because, like anything, if it could, under the pretext of trying to contain the contagion, they'd seek to weaponize it. And
right.
Can you spread psychosis like a contagion through society? And I think they have, and I think the serial killer, terrorism, these things, fear, is in a way doing that, because people lose their critical faculties, and that you can see that as a sort of a psychosis, how people respond to these threats that we're told exist. It is a certain psychosis. Mass communication, I mean, Christopher Simpson's book, The Science of Coercion, talks about the whole study of mass communication, its refinement, was for mass manipulation. And this goes back to the Princeton Radio Project and War of the Worlds and these things.
Right.
It's not there to enlighten or educate. And a lot of these figures, I mean, whether they're put up there to inform us and educate us, they're stage actors, they're spooks, they're OSS agents, like,
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people have this implicit trust in these institutions. It's amazing. Out of ignorance, I suppose.
Right, and another thing too is you can't overlook the drug aspect of a lot of these killers. So a lot of these guys were drug addicts or are on drugs or were on drugs. Mm-hmm. So like Manson, for example. Manson was bombed out of his mind on LSD for all these years.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even really seem to be present. Like, I don't think that guy, whoever he was originally, that persona is gone.
Yeah.
So I think that also suggests, again, a connection to not just the counterculture and the 60s lifestyle or something like that, but, or the Haight-Ashbury lifestyle, the flower child lifestyle, but I think that suggests more is at work, right? I mean, because if you've got guys that have been through these institutions, the prisons, Vacaville, mental institutions, the juvenile institutions, and they've been given or on who knows what hallucinogens, I don't think that you can underestimate the intensity of what can be done through the chemical concoctions that can mm-hmm. be made. I mean, you can, especially back in the 50s and 60s, before people really knew what these drugs were and what they could do. I tend to think that there's probably a connection to the UFO phenomenon as well. This is just a speculation on my part, but, a lot of the experiences that people have on LSD or DMT or ayahuasca and all these different hallucinogens, they tend to speak like they're talking to aliens too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they think they're communicating with the gods or the aliens. So it could also be the case, I'm just throwing it out there, what if a lot of the people who think that they interacted with UFOs, they could have been given drugs, and it would be very easy to simulate or cause someone to believe that in the midst of a serious drug trip.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be very easy to do, especially if, you're Farmer Brown or something in the 50s and you have no idea what LSD or ayahuasca is. You know what I mean? And, you're tested on, and then, all you'd have to do is turn a fan on outside and blink some lights. You know what I mean? Farmer Brown would think that that was a UFO. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
In the midst of it. And so then he comes out. I've seen the space visitors. They came to me last night. I was out of my body, had an out of body experience. Yeah, and all of which lines up with the LSD experience.
And it's a great way to, I mean, if you're going to experiment on someone and when you finish with him, just create like an alien experience, and he's totally discredited. he says, "Hey, guess what happened to me? I was probed by aliens or something." then no one's going to believe him.
Or Dave mentions in one of the cases, kids that were taken had been drugged as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you're a child and you've been drugged or given these crazy drugs, these really intense ones like LSD or something, I mean, I think you would absolutely dissociate. And imagine if the person who molested you, I mean, they could be wearing a Mickey Mouse outfit. And, you could be saying you were molested. I'm not joking, by the way. You could be saying, oh, I was molested by Mickey Mouse. I was molested by somebody wearing an alien. I was molested by aliens. And it was just some pervert in a alien suit.
Yeah.
And you have their immediate cover.
Well, I mean, using drugs to exploit people. I mean, George Hunter White, right? Operation Midnight Climax.
Yes.
Using prostitutes to then film the Johns, and he's the one that famous quote that I what was that quote of his? I raped and murdered something like did it all under the cover of the American flag and had a good time doing it.
Oh wow!
This is a great quote from him. Talking about what he got away with under the cover of national security.
Mm-hmm.
They did this Operation Midnight Climax. They kidnapped people, drugged them, and filmed them having sex with prostitutes and who knows what else. I mean, I was a very minor missionary, actually a heretic, but I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, rape, and pillage with the sanction and the blessing of the All Highest, George Hunter White, who was a counter-narcotics officer and also worked with the CIA. It was part of the early stages of MKUltra, mm-hmm. Operation Midnight Climax. And that whole Operation Midnight Climax, they had these safe houses or in San Francisco.
Right.
Well,
that they bought from the mob. They got it from the mob.
Mm-hmm. And then, as far as the drugs, they went kind of with the Owsley Stanley and the Grateful Dead was the marketing angle for that of spreading, seeding the whole country with LSD, seeing what the reaction would be. And the rock festivals themselves, whether it's Monterey Pop or Woodstock. And Dave McGuire made a point that 1969 was an interesting year because you had the moon landing in July 20th, 1969. You had the Woodstock in August 1969, and also the Manson killings in 1969.
It's really all the year these of teams, the PSYOP, isn't it?
And they're all PSYOPs. And you can see how they're all interrelated, how they react, how they would manipulate the country's emotions one way or the other. I mean, it really is amazing when you see it from the broader picture,
Yeah, I mean, and it's very difficult to fathom. But when you read, Secret Societies and you read Programmed to Kill, you can really get a better picture of how not only is it entirely possible, but that is, the most plausible explanation for all this, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, Jay, listen, I want to think anything else? I mean, you think we covered it or any other thoughts?
I would like to mention the last section just because it's just so funny, bizarre and weird to me. And I've never heard anybody else mention this, but just the character of Jean Bedel Bokassa, the French puppet, and who proclaimed himself emperor in 1977 of Central African Republic. And what's weird about that, by the way, I went after I read this, I went and I watched a bunch of clips and documentaries on this guy. What a wacko. But he liked to eat his people he was victorious over. So he would eat his enemies. And then he fled to France. So a lot of funny how the Ayatollah, didn't he flee to France too?
Yeah, he hung out in France too for a while, yeah. He was pulling his heels there for a while.
A lot of people flee to France. But, yeah, so, we think of cannibalism and these kinds of things as out of the realm of possibility, and nobody does that. But, I think that, again, you get people whacked out on drugs, and they will eat people. That's my concluding salvo there.
Oh, there was one interesting case that you might remember. One of the later serial killers of the 90s, when it was petering out, was this character Joel Rifkin. You might remember him from the Seinfeld. There's a character named Joel Rifkin on Seinfeld. There's a joke. He shared the name of a serial killer. He killed a bunch of prostitutes up in the New York area. Well, it turns out, he was an American serial killer. In 1994, he was sentenced to 203 years in prison for murders of 9 women between 1989 and 1993. He is believed to have killed 17 victims between 1989 and 1993 in New York City and on Long Island, New York area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting is Rifkin often hired prostitutes in Brooklyn and Manhattan. He lived in East Meadow, a suburban town on Long Island. He was a landscaper for William Casey's widow.
Yes, okay. Yeah, somebody brought that up the other day on a YouTube video I did, yeah. So, and also, don't forget Dahmer hanging out with, John Wayne Gacy. Well, Dahmer was able to get his high school class, like the VIP tour of the vice president's office. And then he was going to be an up and coming GOP guy. And then it was John Wayne Gacy hanging out, meeting Jimmy Carter's wife.
That's right. Just after having a conviction for child molestation, he was already a convicted sex offender, and he got the Secret Service button, which usually means they're vetted. which is even more inexplicable. That's just
bizarre. You know, yeah.
I mean, even more inexplicable. And what's interesting, and you mentioned he got the Dahmer got the tour of Walter Mondale's office. I think that was 1977 or 1978.
Yeah.
This may not be connected at all. But if I recall in my research, Walter Mondale sponsored a law, a federal law, which gave bonuses for Child Protective Service personnel when they get kids that are taken out of homes for abuse reasons, supposedly, and get them adopted. It's a federal law. I forget the name of the law itself. Okay?
Mm.
There was Georgia State Senator, I think it was it Deborah Schaefer, who was exposing the corruption in Child Protective Services. That was
a
child trafficking ring. And part of the incentive for these agents that the Child Protective Services do was that federal law. They get like a $5,000 cash bonus for each kid that is removed from that is adopted from foster care, which means that kid first has to be removed from a family and put in the foster care. And she said there was a child trafficking ring being operated under the cover of that service, largely funded by the federal law. Walter Mondale, the senator, was a sponsor of that bill.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. No,
I don't know if that's connected at all to it, but it's interesting to.
Well, it makes sense. But hey, I have a couple questions.
And of course, Jeffrey Dahmer, right? Who was involved in child sex, rape, murder, and all that stuff. You know. So.
Well, I'm curious what you think about Dave's book. Do you agree with the thesis that a lot of the serial killer stuff is hyped up? I mean, I think that, you know, there are contract hits and there are these drug gangs and there is MS-13. That's a real thing. But I mean, do you think the Dahmer thing, for example, was exaggerated, or do you think that it was, the way they told it?
That's interesting.
You think he had, bodies in the freezer and stuff?
I see no reason to implicitly trust what the newsroom reported about that.
Mm-hmm.
That could all be BS.
Right.
And the idea, again, that gets into the whole reason why that gets into Michael Hoffman's thesis. These people may not be as spectacular as they think they are, spectacular in the way that is gruesome as we're told. Because, again, we're dealing with the media, which has an interest in sensationalism in and of itself. But you get into what Michael Hoffman says about the we're all sitting in the pews of the electronic media, and we're all taking this in. And just the reporting of such gruesomeness, gruesome details is going to have that very effect on us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this we'll talk about it, and it has that effect. It's sort of degrading. of society in general.
So what would you say, like in the Henry Lee Lucas case, what do you think is the most, what do you think is most likely that went down, that they just kind of grouped a whole bunch of unsolved ones?
I don't see one man, you know, being guilty, you know, being able to pull off hundreds of murders without he himself getting killed at some point.
Yeah.
It's not easy to kill people. I mean, you can get away with it a few times, but killing a human being is difficult because a human being fights back. So it has to be, I mean, a group of people, I mean, a trained killer can do it, I guess.
Right.
But, it, you know, again, I think Henry Lucas there was there to close a lot of, again, to close the books. One thing that Dave McGowan didn't include in the books that occurred afterwards was the D.C. sniper case, John Muhammad.
Isn't BTK after the book, too?
Yeah, after the book as well. He talks about it because...
Right. In the interview, yeah.
Yeah, in the interview. But the... I'm in the area where the D.C. sniper was... in fact, there's a lady killed just down the street from my brother's house.
Right. Now, there were news stories that he left the death card, which is the Special Forces card.
Yeah.
Do you recall that?
Yeah, I remember that. And then also the fact that... the police chief out in Montgomery County, Moose, apparently was at the same base as John Allen Muhammad out in Oregon.
Huh.
Remember that weird message that he left for him, that cryptic message?
Uh-huh.
And on the phone, he called, he comes out in front of the police station, leaves us, it was almost like it's triggering, and the next day I think he's caught in the, sleeping in the car or something.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Out on 270. Yeah.
Now, was there ever a reasoning for why he was doing that?
They concocted some sort of idea where he was going to go after his wife and then create a bunch of murders to cover it up, which goes in that haystacking thesis. Okay. But they think the media went and said, well, they're probably responsible for these murders too. They actually did that. They share like all these different murders in different states, how John Allen Muhammad is probably responsible for those murders as well. But he himself had some unexplained income. He traveled. Kids went to private school. He went on ski trips. Went to the Caribbean several times.
Oh, he was probably a contract killer.
Yeah, so that's what it sounds like. It's, you know, given the time that happened, it was the fall of 2002, a year after 9/11. And I remember at the time thinking, "What the heck's going on?" And then these weird things were they actually said that. Look for a white panel van.
Yeah, I remember that.
Now, if you drive on the highways around here, I think every 10th car is a white panel van.
So that just makes everybody freak out.
Freak out, yeah. And so and that gets into this whole idea of, you know, whole dose of the serial killers. I remember joking at the time. It was like getting gasoline, pulling people like ducking. I would make my wife go out and pump the gas. Hey, honey, can you get it this time?
Yeah.
I want to live.
It's just as kind of silly as the terrorist story, right?
Your chances of being a victim, right. I mean, you're more likely getting hit by a car or getting in a car accident or getting sniped. But again, it's the psychological effect. And of course, within those killings was this one lady, I think her name was Barbara Franklin, who was an FBI agent who was somehow involved in the weapons of mass destruction cover-up or something.
Okay.
And she was gunned down outside of Home Depot. So that's an interesting case there. But again, it's one of another things. If you look at all these serial killers, the idea of you being killed by a serial killer, the odds. You better you're more likely to get struck by lightning. And but again, the psychological effect. I think David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, even the official narrative, eight victims, six fatalities. And how many homicides are there in New York City every year? You
know? Yeah, exactly. Another thing too, I remember I was reading some of the pop stuff, like Psychology Today articles a few years ago about quote serial killers, and you know it's very PC, and it's like the serial killer is a middle-aged white male who wears the wire-rimmed glasses, and he's very very neat, and he tucks his shirt in, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, actually, you can go look it up, just the mainstream story at least, there's quite a few female serial killers that are never talked about, but they do exist. There are also black guys who were serial killers that are not talked about. Mm-hmm. So actually, I would say that there are, you know, Latino killers who are pretty vicious, especially MS-13 gang types. Mm-hmm. So the idea that this is like the white male, middle-aged white male, is the serial killer is pretty ludicrous. And I also tend to argue, too, that I think women who have no compunction and have had, you know, 5 abortions, I don't see why that's not a serial killer either.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that goes back to what Dave McGowan said about the whole idea of FBI profiling. That's there to mislead the public about what the serial killer is. Meaning, there's aren't these organic guys that go out and, you know, they have this obsession and they're, you know, like in Silence of the Lambs was going after fat like, chicks or like something.
Clarice.
Yeah.
Who's hunting down, you know, Dr. Lecter. Yeah, right.
The myth is they're actually on a mission, and same way in Phoenix, where yeah, they're doing a lot of killing, but there's a reason for it, and they may enjoy it, like in Phoenix, but they have controllers, and the same thing you talk about these MS-13 guys, there's a cult element to it, because that's how you organize, that's how you motivate and control people,
right?
They have handlers, and they're murdering for a reason.
Right? Yes.
They're murdering for a reason.
Well, a lot of the black crime, the soaring black crime rates of the 1960s, at first glance, that may have appeared to be, disorganized or sporadic. But as it turns out, that a lot of these black gangs were being funded by the federal government through the community block grants, and I believe it was revealed in the church committee hearings in the 1970s that Sergeant Shriver, when he ran the Office of Economic Opportunity, gave close to $1 million to this group called the Blackstone Rangers, a criminal gang in Chicago, I think. And what the function of those groups was to more or less just to go out, create mayhem, create a lot of crime, to chase out the whites. And this was all part of this program to destroy the ethnic neighborhoods, the white ethnic neighborhoods, and encourage the creation, the diaspora into suburbia. So this all part of a sort of a strategy, tension, or destabilization. You mentioned that movie Sicario, right? That's where that James Brolin character goes. He tells the lady FBI agent that they're just down there, you know, shaking some trees, stirring up trouble to see what happens. Of course, what that really means on the ground is they're going in there, creating shootouts on the streets, making life a living hell for the inhabitants down there in Mexico, near Juarez, and they could care less. That's the same way that perhaps criminal activities such as drug dealing, importation drugs in certain neighborhoods here in the United States, it could be all part of a sort of a gentrification program. That's 20 years in the offing.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what Catherine Austin Fitz has talked about, right?
And it's the same thing with and that was, I mean, my point is that this was this type of strategy was documented and proven in the 60s with the Blackstone Rangers. You've mentioned how the Black Panthers were radicalized. Mm-hmm. And then
Richard Aoki, yeah.
Yeah, and then taken out when they murdered Freddie Hampton because they got out of control. They've done their job. The shelf life had expired, and then they take them out. And when they're taken out, they're used as propaganda for the police state.
Exactly.
In the 1970s, you had the Sinhalese Liberation Army, right, which grew out of Vacaville and Colton Westbrook.
And that with Charles Whitmore leads to the creation of the SWAT team and federalization of local police.
Federalization of the police force. Yeah, that whole shootout, which is probably staged.
Mm-hmm.
There's some question about Weatherman, right? About the growing out of SDS and why Billy Ayers was never, guilty as hell, free as a bird was his quote. The government, technicality, we can't convict him. And that's his statement. Of course, he's lived a charmed existence.
Right, with a whole bunch of foundation funding behind his stuff. So, yeah.
So, the serial killer thesis fits right into this. It's the whole destabilization and psychological warfare bundled in with targeted killings and drug running and it's what they do. And part of understanding this, I think, is probably it goes back to go back to maybe Doug Valentine's book in the Phoenix program and thinking, how would that be applied domestically? And that's just how it would be applied domestically here. And how it's influenced domestic policy with the Department of Homeland Security, the fusion centers, the idea of, manipulating the media, these things, how it's projected through these movies, through electronic media and promoted. And your question regarding, are some of these stories exaggerated, the gruesome details, are they presented as, yeah, you're right. I mean, there's no reason to assume that's even correct. It's for our consumption.
Good point. Right, yeah, it's very Hollywood, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it's like that, and it's like the serial killer with the heads propped up by the dining room table.
Yeah, like at the end of Seven where... Who is it? Brad Pitt sees his girlfriend's head or something.
Yeah, decapitated wife's head or decapitated her wife in the box there and all that, so... Yeah, so... Well, listen, yeah, it was a great talk, Jay. I really enjoyed it. I mean, your analysis was a good program to kill. Is there anything else?
No, I think that's good. There could be a whole There could be a whole separate discussion of secret societies and psychological warfare. But yeah, both of the books dovetail well.
Mm-hmm. Again, the serial killer phenomenon tends to coincide with the psychological warfare of the post-war era. The sort of the Vietnam War, the economic problems, the trauma, the societal destabilization, the whole thing with society seemed to be turning upside down, and the old rules didn't apply anymore. Families were breaking up, and the increasing divorce rate, all this stuff. It's all part of it. It was all part of it. And you see it in that context.
And I think it's important to point out too that it seems to be consistent, logical phases and steps. Mm-hmm. So. Like I was saying at the beginning, in the pop culture, you get business plans or phases or steps of what's considered revolution and counter-establishment. Back then it was smoking dope and listening to the Doors and sleeping around, free love. Now it's fight the establishment patriarchy's genders that mm-hmm. they've imposed on you.
Yeah.
That's the phases of the degradation.
And you couldn't I'm sorry, go ahead.
As well as passing from, the 60s are a revolution against, the 1940s and 50s corporate man and the company man. And we're going to be free from all that and we're going to be anti-war. And then it becomes the serial killer phase, right? And then it becomes the war on terror phase, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no more serial killers, but there's all the terrorists everywhere.
And then there's also the health scares, like the AIDS crisis, AIDS hysteria.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one, which is mentioned as an actual psychological war preparation.
Yes, for that very purpose, to further degrade society, to hypersexualize society, which is a big part of this, by the way, because the hypersexualization, you get the violence. You get the serial killer. Sex is a big thing with the serial killer.
A sex death cult is a good way to put it,
And it's funny how you remove sex from procreation, you immediately start to veer
it
towards...
It becomes connected to death.
Death, yeah.
Right, the le petit mort, the little death.
Yeah.
As the French term for organism is.
That's interesting, wow. I didn't know that, wow. Okay, well, Jay, listen, I kept you a long time. I want to thank you. I know you've been very busy lately, and you've been very generous with your time. I'm really appreciative of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you'll be headed out soon back to do some more filming, so I wish you safe travels.
Appreciate that.
And we'll talk later on, maybe later in the spring or early in the summer, see whatever comes up. And I'll let you go. And when I post this, I'll send you the link as usual. So.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Take it easy. Good night.
Night.
Bye-bye.